Professor Horn, thank you so much for joining us inside of the Africa Forum.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right. Jamaica is featured in the book. I'd just like our listeners to know that. For those who haven't yet received their copy, those who haven't yet begun reading, that we're featured heavily in this. And this is interesting because the concept of settler colonialism is something that we have been discussing in this space for the last 2 years, 3 years or so, but from a totally different perspective. This morning, we want to talk about that within the perspective of the apocalypse of settler colonialism, the roots of slavery, white supremacy, capitalism in 17th century North America and the Caribbean. Why is Jamaica so relevant to this theme, Prof?
Well, as the book suggests, when the English oust the Spanish from Jamaica in 1655, in the middle of the 17th century, this is a real turning point for the growth of the British Empire and helps to shed light on why people of African descent right now are sitting in the Americas speaking English. Mm-hmm. If you had asked someone if this possibility was relevant in 1654, they might have said we'd be sitting here speaking Dutch, for example,
yes,
or we'd be sitting here perhaps speaking Spanish or even Turkish. What I mean is that at the beginning of the 1600s, England was a second-class power on the fringes of Europe. At the end of the 1600s, England was a major power, indeed a budding superpower, which then passes on the baton in 1776 to its former colony, the United States, now known as the United States of America, which has continued that primacy on into the 21st century, into 2019, although I dare say it may not go to the end of the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, why is 1655 a turning point? Well, what happens then is not only England ousting Spain from control of Jamaica, but at the same time, the Dutch, who I had made reference to a moment or so ago, had temporarily taken over what is now Brazil. But in 1654, 1655, they were pushed out of Brazil by the original colonizers, speaking of the Portuguese, and the Jewish population from the Iberian Peninsula. The Iberian Peninsula, of course, constitutes Spain and Portugal. Recall that in 1492, they had been expelled from the Iberian Peninsula, and many of them went to what is now Turkey, and then, of course, many of them sheltered with the Dutch. They had come to Brazil, and in fact, Angola, too, once the Dutch had pushed the Portuguese out of both territories.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Portuguese making a comeback, the Jewish population felt that it should flee because, you know, I'm sure, that the Spanish and the Portuguese distinguished themselves with their persecution of the Jewish population.
Yes.
That is to say, the Inquisition, which was basically a process whereby you had to convert to Catholicism or die, mm-hmm, or convert to Catholicism or be tortured.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens, serendipitously for the Jewish population of Brazil, when the English seize Jamaica, the English were much more forthcoming, shall we say, to the Jewish population than the Iberians, than the Spanish and the Portuguese. And so the Jewish population then began to flee en masse to what is now Jamaica, and they brought with them not only capital, but skill in producing sugar out of slave labor, or making sugar out of blood, as the saying went at the time.
Mm-hmm.
What happens with the influx of the Jewish population into Jamaica is that this leads to a so-called sugar boom. Recall that sugar was not only used to sweeten one's tea and coffee, it was also seen as a mark of sophistication. It was also seen as a kind of miracle drug. And sugar produced fabulous profits, mm-hmm, that poured into the coffers of London, which allowed London to then increase the size of its navy, being used not only, and its ships not only being used to transport sugar to the markets of Europe, but also to transport poor and indigent English, Irish, and Scots to Jamaica to settle, and also to North America to settle. At the same time, enslaved African labor was needed to produce this crop known as sugar, and the sugar boom allowed London to build more ships to then sail southward to enslave and manacle Africans and drag them kicking and screaming across the Atlantic to this new sugar colony in Jamaica and into the older colony that was Barbados. Now, there are other factors involved as well with regard to what I talk about in this book. The wealth coming from the sugar produced in Barbados and Jamaica, in particular, the wealth that's being generated, this also allows the British Navy and the British military to oust the Dutch from what is now New York City and what are now the Middle Atlantic states. And the Dutch then enters a long, they then enter a long period of decline. By 1672, you see that under the thumb of the monarch, the king, there is a systematizing of the African slave trade in the name of the so-called Royal African Company, which also leads to a quantum leap in the number of Africans who are dragged kicking and screaming across the Atlantic to places like Jamaica. I should mention parenthetically, because I talk about this in the book, that needless to say, people did not want to work for free, and you have major slave revolts that are erupting, not only in the islands, but also in Africa itself, that is to say, the populations that have been targeted for enslavement. In any case, after the formation of the Royal African Company in 1672, then comes another turning point. 1683, you see the Turks stopped at the gates of Vienna. If we can reel back for a moment,
yes,
recall that what helps to drive Columbus across the Atlantic in 1492 has a lot to do with religious conflict between Christians and Muslims. What I mean is that in 1453, the Muslims had driven the Christians out of what is now Istanbul, Turkey. According to one theory, this blocks Western Europeans in terms of reaching the wealth and riches of Persia, now Iran, India, and China. At the same time, the Spanish, who had, you may recall, been controlled by the Muslims for about 700 years, that ends in 1492. 1492 is a pivotal year because, recall, I already talked about the Inquisition of the Jewish population. That basically commences with their expulsion from Spain in 1492. In 1492, the Muslims are ousted from control of their last precinct in Spain, and then about a century later, the Muslims are expelled altogether from Spain. And then in 1492, Christopher Columbus, is tasked by the Spanish monarch to sail westward in search of a new route to the riches of Asia. He stumbles into the Americas, what is now Haiti and the Dominican Republic. He thinks that he is in India, which is why the indigenous people of the Americas are still referred to as Indians. And that helps to give Western Europeans an advantage in terms of the wealth of the Americas, which allows them to wage war successfully against the Muslims.
All right, Prof,
and that brings us back to 1683, when the Muslims suffer a punishing defeat at the gates of Vienna, now Austria, and their what seemed to be their inexorable, inevitable move westward. The Muslims and the Turks enter into a period of decline. But that's important for our story, because recall that when ships from England were sailing southward to Africa to grab Africans, they ran the risk of being enslaved themselves in North Africa in territory controlled by the Turks. Mm-hmm. By the Muslims.
And one of the things I want to do, Pope, I'm sorry to, sorry to interrupt you here, Pope.
Less of a possibility, and therefore that gives a shot of pure adrenaline into the African slave trade, because the Western Europeans do not have to worry as much about being enslaved themselves in the slave markets of Algiers in particular as they're sailing southward. And then my book commences, or excuse me, my book terminates, excuse me, the wrong verb. It terminates in 1688 with the so-called Glorious Revolution, as it's called in London to this very day. This is when the merchants who had been involved in a battle royale with the monarch throughout the 1600s finally triumph and sets the monarch on a path to becoming the figurehead that Queen Elizabeth is today, as opposed to a real, actual governing power. And with the so-called Glorious Revolution, the merchant class also is able to elbow the Royal African Company under the thumb of the monarch, as you might recall, from total control of the African slave trade. And so you have a deregulation, if you like, of the African slave trade, which allows the African slave trade to take another quantum leap forward, bringing more Africans kicking and screaming across the Atlantic to places like Jamaica and Barbados and also to North America. Recall that as the Dutch are being ousted from what is now New York City in 1664, at the same time, you see the English moving into what is now South Carolina, which becomes a major port of entry for the African slave trade.
And it's interesting you should mention that, because you have said a lot there that we want to unpack as we go on. But right now, for example, Ghana has declared the year 2019 as a year of return. We have been talking about that. But Ghana, in doing this through its Ministry of Tourism, which tells us it's primarily a tourism thinking paradigm that they're in, and we are going, but we hear from Ghana that they have begun they talk about 400 years welcoming back Africans in the diaspora to Ghana after 400 years. So they're speaking specifically of what happened in Jamestown. Here in Jamaica, we've had organizations like the UNIA, the Michael Duncan-led UNIA, which have said, listen, we don't like this. We're offended by this. You really should begin in the 1400s, which you have taken us just now. How critical is it for us to make this distinction, even when we talk about the rise of England as from a minor power in the 1600s to become a major power in the late 1600s, as you write about in your book, but to go all the way back to the Portuguese, and then you're taking us also to the Ottoman Empire and saying how important that is in situating the Ottoman Empire, Turkey, now within the context of this mighty power which England became.
Well, you're raising a number of points. Let me try to deal with all of them, but in case I forget, just refresh my recollection. Mm-hmm. I agree with you that the date 1619 is a notional date. Some might call it a fictional date. It's certainly an Anglo-centric date. That is to say, it seems to suggest that what's important is what happens if the English speakers are involved. For example, I'm writing a book as we speak on the 1500s, and in what is now South Carolina, it was not called South Carolina then, in 1526, about 30-odd years after Columbus sails across the Atlantic, you have a major slave revolt, because what happens is that the Spanish, from their perches in what is now Haiti and the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico, they begin moving into Florida, what we now call Florida, and then from Florida moving northward to what we now call South Carolina. But what happens is they're bringing enslaved Africans with them, and the Africans revolt. And in fact, the Africans, in a sense, can be given credit for stalling, if not stymieing altogether, the Spanish reach into what is now South Carolina, because after that revolt in 1526-1527, the Spanish give up, they give up the ghost. They basically retreat back to the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. Or even if you look at Florida, recall that Spain establishes a settlement in what is now St. Augustine, Florida, in 1565. And so you have enslaved Africans in Florida as of 1565, if not before, because recall that Ponce de Leon, the Spanish conquistador, had arrived in what is now Florida in search of, allegedly, of the Fountain of Youth in about 1511, about 20 years after Columbus's rule, Columbus's sailing across the Atlantic. And then if you go back before 1492, in terms of the African slave trade, which I think you, which we traditionally interpret as the transatlantic trade, slave trade, even before that, of course, you have enslavement of Africans. I mean, for example, it's well known that preceding the transatlantic slave trade was a slave trade heading eastward from what is now East Africa, and in what is now Iraq, in the city we now call Basra, for about 20 years, beginning approximately 872 up until about 891, there's a major slave revolt of Africans, which really helps to stymie the ability of these Muslims to further enslave Africans. And in fact, there is a hypothesis that suggests that just as the Western Europeans learned so much from the Arabs and the Muslims, I mean, for example, today we use what are called Arabic numerals, to cite one example amongst many, this hypothesis suggests that a certain amount, a modicum at least, of anti-black and anti-African attitudes stems from this slave trade to the east, particularly growing out of what's called the Zanj Revolt, Z-A-N-J, if your listeners want to plug that into a search engine and look it up. Then you had other attempts by the Western Europeans to enslave Africans in Africa itself. If you look at the history of what would used to be the Portuguese possession known as Sao Tome, you'll find that even before Columbus, the Portuguese were trying to enslave Africans on their own soil. To produce various commodities, but the Africans revolted, and that helps to explain why then the Portuguese and the Iberians began to move westward into the Americas.
One of the things as we talk about unpacking this, Prof, and we're looking at the apocalypse of settler colonialism. So you started off this chat between us by talking about the fact that we are talking English right now in this space. I grew up in a home where I heard my great-grandmother saying, "I'm Arawak and Maroon." That's what she said about herself. It didn't mean anything to us much until much later on. We recognized that by Arawak, she meant Taino, and by Maroon, she was talking about this strong African resistance to enslavement. But in terms of the apocalypse of settler colonialism, can we go forward a little there to come back again to look at the English and the plantation slavery? Because there were people here before. The Tainos were here in the Americas, in Jamaica. We know that they were. Wasn't this in itself the apocalypse in terms of what happened to the Indians who are here?
Well, first of all, they were initial targets of enslavement. That is to say that, keep in mind that in the prelude to Columbus's voyage, enslavement was a free-for-all in Western Europe in particular. I mean, the Muslims were enslaving Christians, the Christians were enslaving Muslims, the Turks were enslaving people in what is now Italy, and vice versa. So when Columbus sails across the Atlantic, the initial targets for enslavement are the indigenous population. And they, of course, are decimated. And what's interesting is that you may be familiar with the Spanish writer and cleric known as Las Casas,
yes.
L-A-S, yes. And then C-A-S-A-S.
Yes.
He began to campaign in about the 1540s against what was happening in terms of the extermination of the indigenous population. And he is rather successful. But his success means that the Spanish then began to step up the process of enslaving Africans and dragging Africans across the Atlantic. I should also say that it was also in the 16th century, the 1500s, that the Spanish had moved into what we now call the Philippines, named after the Spanish monarch, Philip, yes. Felipe. And as well, we see the indigenous population of what we now call the Philippines being dragged across the Pacific, particularly to be enslaved in what is now Mexico, what used to be called New Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And you also see that in addition to enslaving the indigenous population of the Americas,
mm-hmm.
what happens is that the Europeans also begin shipping them all over the world, as particularly to the slave markets of Turkey. They become an initial currency, a commodity. And in fact, you can find Taino and Arawak DNA all over the world if you were to do a DNA test, because they were shipped. They were basically either exterminated or they were expelled. And then this opens the territory for the arrival of more Africans, mm-hmm. which is one of the reasons why you have so many black people in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so that while we look at, and you've written about this, and I've heard you speaking to this in so many of the interviews you have done and the speeches you've made, that so we're looking at this indigenous population as can we say the first apocalypse? Or certainly one of the big ones before the Maafa, and you talked also about the slave markets of the Ottoman Turks, and this is interesting because we don't hear much about that aspect in the narrative when we're talking about slavery, or even when we're talking about settler colonialism, and then the question is why not?
Well, I'm sure you can figure that one out. I mean, people, especially in Washington and in London and in Paris and in Madrid and Lisbon, who rule, do not want to cast a negative light upon their bloody deeds.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd rather talk about freedom and liberty and all the rest. I think mm-hmm. that's one of the reasons why you don't get a fuller story
mm-hmm.
about what I'm along the lines of what I'm talking about. But I should also mention that in terms of this sort of free-for-all involving slavery, that as late as the 1630s, you have ships from North Africa going into the British Isles and snatching people from the British Isles and bringing them back to the slave markets of Algiers, for example. That's a real free-for-all. And even if you look at the hymn of the U.S. Marines, which you might have heard, which begins from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. Tripoli, of course, is in what is now Libya. And what happens as late as the early 1800s is that U.S. Euro-American sailors and seamen were being snatched from ships and enslaved in the markets of Tripoli in North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And then U.S. President Thomas Jefferson had to pay tribute to these North Africans to get back these sailors and seamen, which leads to the empowering of the Marines to go into North Africa and get these U.S. nationals back. as late as the 1850s, and your listeners might be able to find a free copy of this book on the internet. The U.S. Senator Charles Sumner, and of course he was a leading anti-slavery force in the United States of America, he wrote a book that goes into some detail in the 1850s about the slave markets of North Africa and how they ensnared so many Europeans, because he's basically trying to tell these people that we now call white that they should be careful, because what they were visiting upon the Africans had been visited not to the same degree, but to a certain extent upon them, and still was being visited on them in the as late as the 1850s. I should also say that with regard to the Africans and the indigenous population, oftentimes they united, sometimes they did not. But, for example, in Florida, some of the bitterest wars that the U.S. government was involved in were conflicts fighting a joint force of Africans and indigenous, the indigenous known as the Seminoles. In fact, those sports fans in the audience might note that the athletic teams of Florida State University are called the Seminoles. Mm-hmm. They fought wars between about 1816 to about 1856. Now, it's interesting that as this war in Afghanistan unfolds, it's oftentimes referred to as the longest war the United States has been involved in, about 17 years. But actually, this war in Florida was much longer, until finally, in the mid-1850s, the joint force of the indigenous and the Africans are expelled from Florida and are forced to move en masse to what is now northern Mexico, where their descendants continue to reside. Now, you might have also noticed that I use this term white, quote-unquote.
Yes.
And there hangs a tale, because you might have noticed that in the title of my book, I talk about the roots of white supremacy, and
exactly.
It might even be rephrased as the roots of whiteness,
mm-hmm,
because one of the striking aspects
Let me interrupt you a bit. I want to take a break. I'm so sorry. Let me take a break, and we come back to talk about whiteness, white supremacy, and that element of the book. We're speaking with Professor Gerald Horn. His book is The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. We take a quick break. We'll be right back with much more inside of the Africa Forum.